Hello and welcome back to the Affinity Finance podcast. Today I'm joined by Gus Baker, barrister out of Temple Chambers. Gus specialises in consumer credit and financial mis-selling, as well as pension and employment litigation. The topic for today's podcast is limitation and consumer claims. Gus, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you join me today.
Hi, Lauren. Great to be here in my living room today.
Well, I'm in my kitchen. So today, Gus, we're obviously talking about limitation and consumer claims. Now, as many of our listeners will know, consumers and claimants looking to bring claims about historic issues are often met with a problem. The Limitation Act sets out time limits and after which claims can be brought. That often proves a problem with group claims. So to start then, Gus, what would you say are the what are the different limitation periods that most likely impact claims by consumers?
Well, Lauren, if I'm going to talk about claims by consumers that aren't to do with personal injury, there are a few primary time limits in the Limitation Act 1980. And so firstly, Section 2 provides a 6-year time limit for actions founded on tort, and so claims involving negligence. And then Section 5 provides a primary time limit of 6 years for actions founded on breach of contract. And so those are the basic time limits, both of them 6 years, for negligence and breach of contract actions that will face consumers. And as you say, it's a problem in many consumer claims, because by the time a claim has been funded and someone's been referred, perhaps by a claims management company to solicitors, very often the limitation period might have expired because they didn't know that they could bring a claim for that sort of thing. And what we'll talk about today is all of the different ways to try to escape round those 6-year time limits. It's worth saying that there are different shorter time limits for personal injury actions with different exceptions that I'm not a specialist in, so I won't talk about today.
Brilliant. Thanks, Gus. So what are the main exceptions to the rules?
So in a tort claim not involving personal injuries, which are separate, at 14A of the Limitation Act, there's a special time limit where the facts weren't known at the date at which the cause of action accrued, so the date of which the negligence took place. And then for contract claims, well, actually for all claims, Section 32 of the Limitation Act postpones the time limits running in cases of fraud, concealment, and we'll discuss what that means, or action for relief from the consequences of a mistake.
Okay, brilliant. So for our listeners then, Gus, what would they need to know to set time running in a tort claim?
Okay. So say you've got a case where someone has been negligently advised about their pension. So maybe John Bloggs has been told by a pension advisor that he should transfer his pension from a really safe direct benefit, defined benefit scheme to a foreign property investment that looks risky. And John Bloggs does that. He doesn't think that the advice is negligent in any way. He carries on and does it, and then he loses all of his money when the investment goes to pot some years later. Well, he's faced with a problem there, because by the time the investment has gone to pot, it may well be more than 6 years since he received the advice that, when he thinks about it now, and when he gets advice from a solicitor, might say that the pension advisor should never have told you to transfer out of that defined benefit scheme. So does he have any recourse in that situation? And of course, that will apply to advice from solicitors, even advice from claims management companies, or any other professional who's advising you, mortgage brokers, for example. It could be. Well, he will have 3 years to bring his claim from the date at which he had knowledge under Section 14A. And so he will want to say, I didn't have that knowledge until less than 3 years ago. And the defendant will want to say, no, you had the knowledge that you need much before that. So what is the knowledge required for bringing an action in damages under section 14A? Well, it's worth reading section 14A if you're ever in this situation, because it sets out quite a full statutory scheme. But I can skate over it now to explain. So the first thing that you need to know is the material facts about the damage in respect of which the damages are claimed. So you need to know that something has broken or gone wrong and that you've suffered the damage or loss. If you don't know that, then time won't start running. So, for example, if Mr. Bloggs, in my example, invests in the risky scheme, but it seems to go well, there's no way of suggesting that he knows that he might have suffered damage because of receiving negligent pensions advice. If it goes badly, though, it's arguable that he probably does know of the damage because his pension investments might disappear. But that's not the only thing you need to know. What you need to know is a list of things that are mentioned in subsection 8 of 14A. And those are these. A, that the damage was attributable in whole or in part to the act or omission which is alleged to constitute negligence. Now, that is a really tricky issue, because how do you know what your damage is attributable to? So let's just think of the situation of Mr. Bloggs. He's received the pension advice to transfer out of the defined benefit scheme to this risky overseas property. And the overseas property has collapsed. He's lost all of his money. Who does he think is that damage is attributable to? Does he think it's just attributable to the overseas pension, the overseas property providers? Or does he think it's attributable to the people who advised him about his pension? And that's a sort of factual question on which those cases turn. The other thing you need to know is the identity of the defendant. If you don't know the identity of the defendant, then time doesn't start running. So that is going to be really important in situations where you have people hiding behind other people or under corporate structures, or you don't know who the one who provided the advice or did the negligent act would be. And then the last thing you need to know is if it's alleged that the act or omission was that of a person other than the defendant, the identity of that person and the additional facts supporting the bringing of action against the defendant. So in situations where you don't know who is said to have done it, there needs to be more facts that you need to know to bring the action against that new person. The one proviso on all of this is, well, there's two that limit the ability of claimants to use 14A. Firstly, it's irrelevant whether you know or not that the allegation constituted negligence. So say, for example, that Mr. Bloggs he's lost his pension money and he phones up the pension company. He says, I don't think you should have given me that advice. Is that right? Maybe he puts a complaint in, but he doesn't follow through. And then maybe 5-6 years later, he contacts solicitors. Well, in that case, the solicitors can advise him that what the pension company did was negligent, but that's irrelevant. What matters is when he knew there was a real possibility that something had gone wrong or there was a flaw in the advice that he was given. And so that might well be when he phoned up and questioned that advice. So that's section 14A9. And section 14A10 is a provision about what's sometimes referred to as constructive knowledge. And so actual knowledge is what you actually knew, but constructive knowledge is there to stop people turning a blind eye or claiming to turn a blind eye, because your actual knowledge includes knowledge which you might reasonably have been expected to acquire by facts that you can see or by facts ascertainable to you with the help of appropriate expert evidence. So if it looks like something's going wrong, but you just close your eyes and ears to it, then you have a risk of failing on the constructive knowledge provision, meaning you're fixed with a limitation date more than 3 years before when you've brought your claim, meaning you might be out of time. So it's a complicated statutory scheme, but the big important headline is that claimants who think that something has gone wrong in a potential negligence claim need to contact solicitors as soon as possible, and claims need to be issued within 3 years of the date of knowledge, or standstill agreements need to be entered into, because these are technical and fact sensitive issues which are under section 14A.
That's brilliant advice. Thank you very much, Gus. Appreciate that. So you've obviously clearly run a lot of these claims. What is a mistake?
Well, so mistake under section 32 of the Limitation Act is one of the reasons for postponing the primary limitation period running. And unlike section 14A, which can only apply to claims in tort, primarily negligence claims, section 32 can apply to contract claims, as well as claims for restitution of monies. And so this is particularly relevant in cases where someone says that they've paid away some money to someone else, but then wants to, but says they did that under a mistake of fact or law. Now, one of the key criteria is the mistake must be an essential ingredient in the cause of action. And so it's important to note that these are quite restricted in how Section 32 is going to act. But also there's a proviso that the period of limitation shall not begin to run, not just until someone has discovered the mistake, but could have, with reasonable diligence, have discovered it. So if you pay away money when you thought you had an obligation to, or both parties thought that they had an obligation to, but because of a mistake of fact or law, that obligation wasn't there, you may well be able to postpone limitation running under section 32(1)(c). But if you could, with reasonable diligence, have discovered it, then limitation will run from that period rather than the latter one. So these are cases which often relate to overpayments to people, or payments that were wrongfully made when there was no contractual requirement to make the payment. And again, mistake has a technical meaning and has to be within the essential cause of an essential ingredient of the cause of action, rather than just, I wish I didn't do that, I entered into a bad bargain because I misunderstood what the terms meant. That latter bit probably won't be enough.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much for that, Gus. It's been a pleasure to host today's podcast with you. To finish, Gus, can you leave us with some of your top tips?
Well, OK, if you are an individual, the top tip is to act quickly to avoid getting time barred by limitation. If you're a solicitor, often I see people being slightly too slow on thinking about limitation in cases. And so you need to really think about the trade-offs between, when you're investigating a new type of claim, getting advice, gathering evidence, and checking how meritorious the claim is, which could take a while, and some claims might have expired by the time that process is finished, versus issuing a claim that you don't know how good it is right at the beginning, and you're left with the chances of having paid an issue fee and risk the other side's costs on the basis of a claim that might turn out not to be meritorious. So there's a real trade-off there that solicitors need to think about. But one way of getting round that trade-off, if the defendant will play ball, is to enter what's called a standstill agreement with the defendant. And in consumer claims, it would be good to see solicitors entering those standstill agreements as quickly as possible, or asking for the standstill agreements as quickly as possible, which gives both sides a period to breathe and think about the merits of the claim without limitation breathing down their neck.
Super. So, in a nutshell, act quickly, get the good advice, and enter a standstill agreement as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. If it was as easy as that.
I'm sure it's not. Super. Thank you so much, Lauren.
No problem at all. Gus, we've really enjoyed today. Thank you very much.